I didn't really want to hear it, you know? I think you should.
What the fuck?
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Beverly Hills 90210. Today's episode, Season 9, Episode 15, Beheading St. Valentine. And now here are your hosts, Tari Ariano and Sarah D. Butting.
Okay, I didn't notice that funky music on the intro clip, and I clipped it until I was listening back to it.
That is amazing. Wow. I'm just picturing like Richard Dawson in a very wide necktie writing on his blue card while, what's his face?
Gene Rayburn
is stalking around being a weirdo.
If only that were what we were watching.
I put Donna
instead.
In my blank. Ooh. Oh.
Yikes. All right, let's get into it. Starting with our C plot, Steve skin cancer stuff. Yes, really. So Janet arrives at work to find the office full of underwear model types getting interviewed in an extremely professional manner. She doesn't know what the idea is, but she hates it. And it's correct. Of course, the idea is to have page three girls in the beat as they are in British tabloids. Janet says those girls are topless. Steve is not prepared to stoop that low. Bikinis are fine. And David is just helping out at Steve's request. It's all very bad. Clip two.
Sleaze is one thing, you guys. Skin is another.
This is a Southern California newspaper. Beach, sun, fun. Those are all newsworthy topics.
Oh, so we're serving our readership.
Publisher's duty, isn't it?
And if you two are serviced in the process.
Double bonus.
Hashtag time's up. Oh my God. You assholes.
God.
You fucking assholes. Steve has also set up a sun lamp right in front of Janet's desk. And later, she is trying to work while Steve sits topless in front of the sun lamp in the office. You can see in the visual aids. I regret to say. Thanks a lot, Sarah.
Sorry.
To promote the new Page Three Girl initiative, they're going to do a publicity stunt at the beach. I guess Steve needs a base. Janet realizes she needs to stop looking for dignity in this job right before Steve gives her sunscreen to put on his back, which is not pointed at the sun lamp right now. Not sure what the point is of putting sunscreen on to sit in front of a sun lamp either, by the way. But
I think it was
late.
Actually like aloe vera lotion to soothe his sunburn from the sun lamp. Great job, Blondie.
Yeah, it's too late anyway, apparently, as Janet tells him he has a really weird mole on his back and urges him to get it checked out. And it turns out Steve's derm is Bernie Coppell from The Love Boat. So two generations of Aaron Spelling stars captured in one frame.
Ugh.
He tries to impress upon Steve the dangers of tanning by saying that the mole is irregular, which could indicate carcinoma. And as a blue-eyed blonde, Steve needs to be more careful in the sun. Would you care to comment on this as someone who has had a similar situation?
Not really. I mean, okay. I don't understand what skin cancer PSA is doing in this fucking show, especially in season 9 of this fucking show. Like, this belonged in season 1. But anyway, all the advice that they give is more or less correct, except it's not just blondes and you should use SPF maximum available, not just 15.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I mean, they didn't do anything dangerous. The mole looked more like an ingrown hair to me. And I've had a bunch of these taken off, but I just wonder what how much Bernie Coppell lost in the executive poker game at Big Daddy's mansion that he had to do this. But
indeed.
Yeah. So anyway, Steve's not going to die. Spoiler.
Right. So he confides in Janet about his exam, which has him worried enough to go research melanoma at the library. She says it could be nothing, which he says is exactly what he's done with his life, which true. He's worried about his legacy in general and also that he's blown it with Janet. But apparently he hasn't, because the next day she's at his house getting ready to leave after what Steve fears was a mercy charity event for her. I mean, she brought a change of clothes, so probably not. She liked that he looked at his life and determined that something was missing. He's called a bunch of different places about volunteering his time, and she urges him to make changes he can live with permanently. But apparently he's not ready to start living a life he can be proud of just yet, as Janet finds him at the beach giving out copies of The Beat with a bevy of bikini models. He then weirdly starts lecturing the crowd about skin cancer. And indeed, he is covered up like fucking Katharine Hepburn, as you can see in the visual aids. He's in like a shirt and a hat with a veil, like it's the whole nine. So he says all the bikini models are also covered in sunscreen, and some people in the crowd start leaving, but Janet is proud and kisses him, whatever. At the club the next night, Steve tells Janet he's fine. She wants to encourage him to start his whole living right initiative, but he lets himself get engulfed by a crowd of bikini models instead. Blah, blah, blah stuff.
This is every Steve storyline. Every Steve storyline forever.
Really true. On to the B plot. When she's not trying to break up Donna and Noah, Gina worries that she's not horny enough for Dylan, and also David's in the mix too. So Gina is training a new mom on her back patio when the doorbell rings. It is Dylan. He stalked Gina there with her date book, and with her client right there, runs upstairs. Gina goes back to position her client for crunches and races back to find Dylan, who is like got a lot of manic energy, and he's rooting through the client's dresser because he's trying to distract himself from heroin cravings, at least the chemical ones, because now he wants to fuck. And this is all played for comedy as Gina tells him she's working and then tries to run away from him, but apparently the sound of her client counting crunches makes her horny, and fucking on said client's bed ensues, and it's not okay. I was really upset by this.
Well, and also she like tries to leave the room and he grabs her and pulls her back in a way that if it weren't for the like Bun Chicka music on the soundtrack, like he's assaulting her.
Yeah. It's really jarring.
This is not the time or the acting core for a reenactment of Permanent Midnight where he's like fucking the cravings away. Like no one wants to see that or even think about it. Goodbye.
So Gina takes Dylan for a run. She's proud of him for fighting cravings by getting the blood rushing, and then tells him she ran them to her first school, which was also the place she first failed in her first competition in second grade. She's still bitter about the medal in the trophy case with her rival's name on it. Then more running. So Noah's going to be working Valentine's Day, but for once thought ahead and booked him and Donna a room at the Bellage, where else, for that very night, February 12th. Donna is impressed. David comes in to say he needs a date for a party at his station manager's house. He can't go alone because the guy's favorite part of David's show is the relationship advice. LOL.
Idiot.
Donna suggests saying his girlfriend's out of town. Hey, I have a suggestion too. Don't lie to your boss. Just a thought.
Or
if he listens.
If he listens, he knows your situation.
Exactly. Because you whine about it all the time. But instead, Donna gives him a whole tale to sell, but David's already made up a story for the two of them to try to sell together. She acts like she's not going to do it, but of course we all know she's a doormat and definitely will. And her argument here is that it puts Noah in the weird position of saying no. How could he? Particularly when she just let him go to an awards show as Clara's date like two episodes ago. But David accepts that and leaves. And Donna's getting ready for her big night with Noah at the Bellage when Gina, on her way out, offers Donna her butterfly clips because it's the 90s. They're in her jewelry box. Donna then comes out, French tips a quivering, and asks them to explain the photo strip that was also in there. That was so many episodes ago. Congratulations to the writers for remembering things that happened this season. Anyway, Gina is a pretty good liar in clip 3.
Oh. What? Gina, what is the reason that you are staring so intently at my boyfriend in these pictures?
Oh, this is the night, remember, that Noah was wasted and you asked me to keep an eye on him.
Your eyes on him, not your lips. Noah, jump in here anytime.
I'm just kissing him on the cheek here. I mean, we were just posing for the camera, remember, Noah?
I don't even remember leaving the bar that night, all right?
That's great. So you blacked out. That's supposed to make this okay?
Look, why don't you get your things? We'll check in. We'll talk about it.
Talk about what? Things you seem not to remember? I think I'll pass. You two have a good night.
So it was fine when he was blackout drunk and he and Val had blackout roofie sex. Mm-hmm. That was a fucking felony.
Yeah.
But this exact circumstance, which he can't remember, so in your moral universe, that means he's not responsible. That's a problem.
Right. Also, this is like such covert activity that Gina documented it in a fucking photo booth. And also, the pictures of them are so ridiculous. He's Vincent Young is just sitting there like a fucking butter statue, like always, with like Gina's hands are all over him. Like he's clearly not involved in whatever it is she's doing. No. Like he's terrible. Don't get me wrong.
He's
like
a butter statue. That's the best.
You know what I mean? But it's
he
true.
Is. He is.
Anyway, it's all very dumb. So at the peach pit, Noah yells at Gina for purposely making sure that Donna found the photo strip so that it would hurt her feelings. I actually don't think that Gina planted it there. The way she was acting, she does seem like she legitimately forgot. Like there was there's nothing in her manner tipped that like this was a trap for Donna to fall into.
I think that she did keep it so that she could use it for this, yes. But I think she also forgot where she kept it and was like sort of pleasantly surprised that this came up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she definitely like was a good improviser and like rolled with it when it came up, but nothing about it made it seem like, oh, now's my chance to ruin Donna's Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Anyway, so here's what happens, clip four.
Ever since you got here, you've been hanging around an awful lot. I think you love the fact we were having problems.
Why don't you just tell me what you're accusing me of already?
Enjoying her misery.
You know what? I'm glad Donna found the photographs. I mean, she deserves to know the truth, right?
You told me nothing happened.
Well, I didn't want to hurt Donna's feelings, but... Ooh, it's kind of been killing me, you know? I mean, keeping your little secret.
What secret?
Hey, Dylan. Where can I get you?
I'm actually just here to pick up Gina. Why don't you give me an espresso to go?
The machine's out of whack.
It's espresso. Espresso, world traveler. Mm. But see, like here she is sort of like, oh, well, you know, I didn't plan this, but since the opportunity has presented itself.
Mm-hmm.
Shit, meet my stirring spoon. Sure.
Gross. So outside as they're leaving, Dylan asks what that was about. She brushes it off, says she assumed they were going to spend the night at his place, but he just wants to get dinner somewhere other than the peach pit and take her home. And she gets all pinchy, but he says it's because he has a shift in the morning, and she promises to let him sleep, but he nicely declines. And then she asks if he's sick of her. She takes off her jacket, drops it at his feet, tells him she wants him to say, Gina, I want to be with you tonight. And if he doesn't, she's going to strip in the parking lot. She gets down to her bra, which is when Nat comes out. Dylan hides her behind him. She shows she's actually taken the bra off and chokes him with it. Her place it is. This is way too much work.
Stuff?
I don't know. Yeah. So Noah brings Donna some flowers, which she says make him look guilty. True. All he can do is guess about what he did with Gina that night, which doesn't reassure Donna and shouldn't, by the way. Yeah,
nor should it. I was just going to say.
Based on past experience. Hello. But in the meantime, she has decided to go to the party with David after all. And he's pissed, but doesn't really have any standing at the moment, as we hear in clip five.
If I told you not to go,
then I would tell you to go ahead and get angry and then get over it. Because that's what I'm trying really hard to do.
Good line. And she's right.
Yeah.
Moving on their way into the party, David and Donna tweak their cover story, although he says they met in high school and she's dubious that they've been together ever since. Here's what they settle on. Clip six.
So here's the deal. We broke up. We got back together
and decided we were perfect for each other.
Yeah, that's what happened until you broke up again.
And then it happened again. And then you broke up again. And now we're all just waiting for you to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And then there'll David be a video greeting from Jason Priestley, and then we'll all be done with this steaming mess.
So then
in 2 years,
David remembers that his boss may have met Sophie at some point. Again, the writer showing off that they remembered a thing, and says that they met at a club and he and Donna met at a club. And she was all over him. She counters with they met at a poetry reading as if either of them would ever do that. But then they're up to the boss, whose name is Billy. His wife, Sharon, wants to call into the show every time the two of them have a fight. And when David says he was thinking of cutting back on the advice portion, Billy protests that it's the best part. You are bad at your job, Billy.
Yeah.
He goes
go back to England.
Seriously, Billy goes to get the photographer that for some reason they've hired to work this party. And when the first pick he takes is, in Sharon's opinion, bad, She requests that David and Donna kiss for a retake, and oh no, it's too real, as you can see in the visual aids, because of Gifted. Afterward, David and Donna comment on how easy it was to slip back into their old relationship, but also how long ago it was, and how they're almost like brother and sister now, though they did once used to sleep together. And when he goes in for another kiss, she's into it, and then they both freeze and decide to go into the club, where Gina and Dylan are at a table making out. Dylan wants to go fuck in a bathroom stall, whereas Gina would rather go somewhere normal because it's Valentine's Day. Oh, Dylan, you old softy. And then Donna apologizes to Noah for suspecting that he did something shitty to her when he was drinking Queen of the Doormats.
Oh my God, she really should go with Matt.
Unable to learn from anything or remember further than 10 weeks ago. Noah graciously forgives Donna for her completely founded suspicions. But
you might even say he melts. Because butter.
When he asks about the party, she doesn't tell him about the kisses and just requests that they burn the photo strip. This will definitely not be an issue when Noah sees the picture of Donna and David kissing in the paper or whatever the fuck, which I assume is coming, but I don't remember. Gina brings Dylan to a cloth napkin restaurant where his newly sober ass drinks red wine. She's just trying to have a conversation, but he obnoxiously starts singing When the Saints Go Marching In over her loud enough for a waiter to have to come over and tell him to shut up. And somehow Gina finds this charming and delightful and joins in. I don't know. And after the restaurant, they end up by the beach where Dylan wants to fuck against a tree, like right beside the pedestrian path. And Gina is putting him off and she's sort of being flirty about it, but it's still enough to get a guy who's walking his dog to stop and make sure he's okay, which I was kind of glad they included, actually. Like, this is how your behavior looks to someone on the outside of a relationship. Like, please think about this and adjust your behavior.
Yeah. Also, I love that the guy was walking a German Shepherd who was as big as Dylan. I would have eaten him in one bite, and I'm a little sorry that that didn't happen. Good dog.
So when he has moved on, Gina tells Dylan he makes her feel like she has to let him pressure her into doing stuff he wants her to do or he'll drop her. And he actually hears her and asks what she wants. She wants him to take her home and tell him that he cares about her, and he agrees. So growth? Question mark. Whatever. The club has emptied as Noah looks back and David in his smooth jazz and pities him for still being on the air on Valentine's Day. And then the band comes back in to play Noah's special request for Donna.
Barf.
He pulls her onto the dance floor. And as the song goes on, he checks again that they're okay after the whole thing with the photos. And she insists that he forgot and she wants to forget while looking longingly over his shoulder at David.
And making Barbie hand.
Uh-huh. And at the beach apartment later, Noah meets up with Gina in the kitchen and is shitty to her in clip 7.
I heard you and Donna work things out. That's great.
So where's your Valentine?
He's in the bedroom. He's kind of worn out.
Right. Just keep telling yourself you're too much for him. I like that.
I was enough for you. You weren't roaming around very much on our little night together. Actually, you passed out. Right?
Why do you keep hitting around? Just tell me what happened that night.
Nothing. I mean, nothing that you haven't already done tonight.
Or nothing. Dumb.
Who cares?
Dumb. Very dumb. Oh, God, please save us all from David's deep thoughts. Clip 8.
Why? Here's what I like about holidays. They remind us of the way we should act every day of the year, but don't. Like choosing a Valentine, you know, just picking that one person and saying, I'm yours and you're mine, and loving them no matter what. Appreciating what you got, that's the upside. The downside is a big, lonely reminder of what you don't have.
Well, maybe you wouldn't be single if you weren't such a fucking asshole every time you're in a relationship.
Or if you didn't have a geometric beard, or if you wore clothing that fit your body.
All of those are possibilities.
Mm.
We still have an A plot to get to, but first, we have a message for Vesna.
Vesna's friend Rebecca has let us know that her friend and fellow 90210 obsessive, Vesna, is a fashion designer. And to mark the occasion of Vesna's birthday, Rebecca wants us to list 5 ways Vesna's a better fashion designer than Donna. Only 5?
I know.
Okay.
She did say in her note, or 10, but I limited it to 5.
I saw that. Yeah, that was funny.
Number 1, if Vesna came across evidence that a client was using sweatshop labor, she would contact the appropriate authorities to investigate, not Brandon to do a journalism about it.
Number 2, Vesna would never steal a fellow designer's sketches, even if the concept she was stealing was just a pair of color-blocked kids' swim trunks.
Number 3, Vesna wouldn't let her dowdiest friend talk her into partnering up on a clothing store.
She does wear a lot of beige. Number 4, if she did somehow let herself be tricked into such a venture, Vesna wouldn't let said dowdy friend decorate the joint, open it the very next day, and name it with a failed pun because she doesn't know how rhymes work.
And number 5, if Vesna were to dress a pop star for a red carpet, she would accompany her to style her on site, not let her go wild with a dumb boa and mesh tank top thing.
Indubitably. Donna's friends wish they knew a designer as talented as Vesna and surely would be jealous of Rebecca because of it. From all of us here and Rebecca,
happy birthday, Vesna! On to the A-plot. Kelly's still got problems with Matt and Mrs. Matt. So Kelly is looking sour and dressing the window mannequins to match her all in black, forcing Donna to point out that it's almost Valentine's Day, so maybe something red? Matt has left messages, but Kelly hasn't called him back. And right on cue, Matt comes down and loiters outside, waiting for Kelly to come out, which she does. Before he explains, he wants to mention something. He can't afford the hotel forever, so he's going to bring Lauren back to the Walsh house in case Kelly wants to avoid it. He's just trying to do the right thing. Kelly recaps their whole arc to say she thinks it's a little late for the right thing. Again, she's not totally wrong, but still, shut up, Kelly. So then Kelly is leaving the store when Matt says he wanted to tell her about Lauren. Kelly says he should have. I hope Lauren signed off on him telling Kelly her business, because that's what he does abruptly in clip 9.
Seriously.
Lauren has schizophrenia. She's been living in a mental hospital for the last 3 years. They've tried all these different drugs on her, but nothing helped.
I don't understand. She seemed fine.
Clozapine. Never heard of it?
No.
Well, I didn't think that was going to work either, and then suddenly it did. It's hard talking about Lauren coming back as anything other than a happy surprise, but that's what it was. A surprise.
You should have told me about her.
We met in high school. 19, we're living together. 20, cutting the wedding cake. And it's about a year later, she's taking the scissors to her furniture.
When was she diagnosed?
One day, we're walking in Tribeca, and she's talking a mile a minute. To God, they're arguing because he's telling her to do something bad.
It's a terrible disease.
Psych, yeah, bitch. I think that's his point, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, Matt says no one had any hope that Lauren would get better. He wanted her to because he loves her, but now everything's so screwed up because he loves Kelly, too. Why? The next morning, Matt finds Lauren making French toast. He's mildly worried that she didn't sleep, but she says she just had hay fever. No big deal. She got up and watched music videos, and there sure are a lot of women headlining their own acts now. A bunch of them should tour together because she was institutionalized and doesn't know about Lilifair. Get it? Just a note here that being in a mental hospital is not like being on the moon. I think you're allowed to read magazines and shit. But anyway,
even on the moon, you know shit that's happening.
That's true.
Satellite you out some internet. Come on.
Very true. So Matt tells her about Lilifair and she bitterly says that probably happened when she was strapped down or doing arts and crafts, and then serves him up 2 slices of French toast that she hasn't actually fried yet. And gets all rattled, and he nicely tells her it's no big deal, and he'll help her learn how to do things again. And she confesses that she lost her ring while she was away, and he says he took it off her because the doctors thought the diamond could hurt her. And that's when she notices he's not wearing his ring either and jokes that it could have hurt him, but she's just joking, kind of, and they hug. And Matt finds Kelly in her room getting her stuff out. And for having only fucked him twice, she sure keeps a lot of bras there. But do you want to talk about her hair since you cut this this pic?
Wardrobe clearly hates her. Like, they have her in so many layers. Like, it's actually realistic, I guess, that this is what you, like, this is the heartbreak uniform. But I don't think you would let him see you like this, or her.
Right.
And the hair is just like scraped back. Like, this is just Jenny Garth's hair. It's very fine. So sometimes putting it in a ponytail results in these little, you know,
flyaways.
Yeah. And fins. And she just has like pins jammed in it. And then there's like a leather strap around the ponytail. And then there's like a sweatshirt under a leather jacket. Like, this is the leather jacket phase where they're all wearing creaky leather blazers in every scene. And like, I had one too. It, 90s, whatever.
Sure.
I mean, yeah, like, they're just, I feel like they are at pains to make her look like shit. Like, especially in this episode, they're putting her in like wide V things that aren't flattering. Her hair is like pasted down along her head and it's razored at the end. It just looks like a little child. She looks like a 5-year-old.
Yeah.
It's just not, it's not a flattering moment for her. And it's not even a like between hairstyles thing. They could do something with it, but they didn't. So she must have been in like peak hag form at this time, because they are not helping her even a little.
No. So then she gets snitty about Matt's never having made her a key like he said he was going to, as if she wouldn't have had a key to this house for years. Like, I'm so sure they changed the locks ever.
Or even used them. Give me a break. The back door was always open. Come on.
Seriously. So to her question, he says what he wants for Lauren is that she feels safe and loved. And then he also wants for himself to go home every night to Kelly. Not getting this from how you're treating Lauren, to be honest. It seems like you're giving her to understand you want to resume your marriage. But when she doesn't answer, he says she's also got shit in the bathroom, which is kind of funny. Then Kelly.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Kelly's on the deck moping so performatively that Dylan sends Gina inside so that he can talk to Kelly instead and give her their perspective of a guy just trying to keep living after losing his wife. Kelly is not sure what her role is with Matt, as we hear in clip 10.
So what? I forget about him and congratulate myself on being a nice person.
Someone's got to do it, and it's not going to fucking be us.
Isn't every moment of your life congratulating yourself for being a nice person, Kelly?
This scene was frustrating because, like, I don't feel sorry for her at all, and I am no longer capable of feeling sorry for this character for anything. Anything bad that happens to her, I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
Up to a point, and we'll see what that is at the end of the season. Spoiler, I guess. But this is actually, like, it has the, like, seeds of a good scene in it. Like,
yeah,
Luke Perry is actually pretty good when he's like getting real about, like, you know, in the part right before this clip, that he's like, you know, do you know how many deals this guy made with God?
Right. Yeah.
And he just sounds very real, that he's like, this is an exhausting way to live, and try to have some empathy for him, even though he shouldn't have put you in this position. Like, it's actually pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. Right,
like, true emotional writing that is, you know, but then they put in like sad guitar.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh my God. Like, we actually get from the words for once how everyone is feeling.
Right.
You don't need to indicate. So yeah, it's too bad, because this storyline is extremely frustrating and poorly conceived. But then there was this almost nice moment in it that was spent on fucking Kelly.
Yeah, because as you say, like, it acknowledges, you know, this character's backstory, that it makes sense that this character, that Dylan would try to give her the perspective of, like, where Matt is coming from, because he has empathy for him, even though he doesn't particularly like Matt. Like, he gets what his situation is, in a way.
Yeah.
And the writers are remembering things about him. Like, it's like the opposite of everybody trying to have an intervention with Dylan without being like, and I know from when I had a substance abuse problem, which is like everyone except Steve and Janet.
Yeah. Was there like a shift change?
I know.
Honestly. On this episode and the last one where they're like, it's Sophie, we remembered a thing. It's like someone left them a stack of note cards.
Right.
like photo over the strip. Weekend. Yep. Remember when this happened? Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, Dylan says that Kelly has no choice except to let Matt go. She says she thinks she does, and Dylan says, pretend you don't, which I thought was pretty good. Yeah,
that was good, too. And he's like, you know, you have the option not to be a bitch here. And she's like, do I? And he's like, I don't.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't. Think it over.
Right. But she can't. She wants Matt back. Seriously, why? Why? Seriously,
you
why?
Hate him.
You just want him back because someone else has him. Like, 100%, that's why.
Yeah.
Anyway.
110.
The next day, she's all mopey at the delivery of an engraved keychain for the key to Matt's place that she never got / always had. Let's be real. Her sad face is ridiculous. Sarah made a gorgeous four pack.
Cat butt quatrefoil.
Yes, it's gorgeous. Oui. So many elaborately sad faces from Jenny Garth in this episode. Oh,
so much jaw jutting.
I know. So Matt is brooding in his office and playing with his ring, which he's dug out from wherever it was, when Kelly barges in and accuses him of leading her on, which, to be fair, he did. She says he can't love two people at once, so he needs to tell her if he loves Lauren more so that Kelly can move on. Obviously, we hate her around here, but this is completely fair. Like, he does have to do that.
Yeah.
She's right.
No, he does. For the sake of both of them and his own sanity. Like, just decide.
Right.
Or so choose he, you. How about that?
Right. Exactly. He begs her not to ask him that, which is kind of an answer in itself, I guess. So she leaves, rudely stomping right past Lauren without greeting her. Like, this is not Lauren's fault. This is Matt's fault. But I get it, I guess. So Kelly's closing the store when Lauren comes to talk to her. And Kelly is a bitch about it, obviously, in clip 11.
Well, I came to ask you a favor.
Okay. But, not really feeling that generous right now.
Right now.
Please don't fight for him, Kelly.
This is not fair.
Well, I lost everything because I was sick. 3 years just gone. I want my life back. And to get it, I have to rely on your kindness. Is that fair?
No, that's the worst position anyone could be in.
Yeah, Kelly's kindness. That's... tough gig, Lauren.
Thin gruel.
Yeah.
So Kelly goes straight from there to the Walsh house to not fat fight for Matt in our final clip.
I know that you love me. It's okay.
You know, when you love someone, you say these things, these big things. Like you'd give anything for their happiness, their health.
You never think that it'll actually end up costing you something.
I meant those things when I said them to Lauren. So I have to mean it now.
I think I love you more because you do. That's what makes it so hard for me to say goodbye. Made me really happy. I just wanted you to know that.
Objection. Facts. Resolutely not in evidence.
Totally.
You despise him.
Yeah.
Run
you don't
away.
Even respect him. Yeah. No. Honestly. But I mean, this is, she is doing something selfless because he's too much of a coward to actually like pick a lane. So she is doing something kind for Lauren because Matt is being shitty. But I love that her declaration has to start with, I know that you love me. Like, so conceited. God.
She sucks.
Anyway, that's the episode. Goodbye. this love affair. Let's talk about who is our MVP. God, I don't know. Gina for stirring the shit, trying to make some drama happen.
I'm going to go with Lauren. Just like, look, this wasn't my fault. And also, Blondie, get bent. Like, sure. Also, she made Kelly miserable, not on purpose, but it happened. So good for you, girl.
True. All right. Least valuable player. Billy, the idiot who thinks David has good relationship advice.
Yeah. I mean, I would say no to the butter sculpture, but I like butter. Kelly.
Yeah, Kelly.
Like, just if you have to bring a blanket outside to mope, just mope inside.
Yeah. Although also Matt really did not cover himself with glory with his handling of all of this.
Yeah.
Even though, as you said in the last episode, this was entirely the writers like just making something up like midstream for his arc and fucking over this actor to have to try and play.
Yeah, and then he's like, I love two people. I'm like, I'm not even convinced. I'm not even convinced you have a pulse, much less that your heart is torn in two. So, all right.
Yeah, indeed. All right, let's do the Kim challenge.
Bad, bad, and dangerous to me.
5 ways from this episode that Dylan proves he is mad, bad, and dangerous to know. It's bad to show up at your girlfriend's work and try to fuck her in her client's bedroom.
It's bad and dangerous to try to fuck your girlfriend within sight of pedestrians.
It's dangerous to be drinking wine when you're supposed to be sober, I believe.
It's probably not great to blow off the extra community service hours you totally just got like 2 days ago in the timeline of the show, but which you're not doing because you got all this time for fucking.
It's also bad to start fucking when you're like still covered in dirt from your community service job. Like, take a shower first. Gross. Next 5.
Yes, it does. And now we return to those thrilling days of yesteryear. Luke Perry, teen heartthrob. I don't think I realized how thick the pages of this book were or how soon in the show's run it came out, because we are close to its end.
Oh, wow.
Which is either too bad or a relief. Today's section is titled Luke Perry in Private. The picture on the facing page is captioned, Luke Perry thrives on excitement, and he's wearing a Planet Hollywood t-shirt, a leather duster, and sunglasses, and he's being escorted by police somewhere. Thousands of people see Luke every week on 90210, but many of his fans wonder about the real Luke Perry. Do they? One thing his fans may not know is that the actor is shy. Luke still gets nervous whenever he has to face a crowd. Luke doesn't get nervous, though, when he bungee jumps, parenthesis.
Oh, my God.
In bungee jumping, a person jumps off a bridge or high crane while attached to an elastic bungee cord.
Ooh,
end
do parens. They?
I know. Really? He usually jumps with his pal Jason Priestley, insert splatter comment here, who first told Luke about the sport. Quote, I like constant excitement in my life, said Luke. I like the challenge of doing things that scare me. Luke added that this daredevil sport is the most exciting thing he has ever done. Luke also likes tamer pastimes. He can often be found on the basketball court playing a game with friends. He also enjoys fishing, good movies, and listening to classic rock and roll and opera.
I don't believe that for a second. Not his for 1 second.
No.
Do I believe Luke Perry listens to opera for fun?
No. His favorite musicians are B.B. King and Jerry Lee Lewis. He even named his pet Chinese pot-bellied pig Jerry Lee. Oh, 90s. Since the studio cast him on 90210, Luke has lived in the Los Angeles area, far away from his family and friends. We get it. Jesus. It's difficult for my family to see each other often, said Luke. I live in Hollywood, Tom is in Chicago, and everyone else is in Ohio. But we sure try. No one cares. Has Luke changed much since his rise to stardom? Luke admitted that at first he liked all the attention, but he didn't want to get carried away with it. He told himself that if the Hollywood lifestyle ever started to change him, he would leave. Quote, I'd go back to Ohio and get a job driving an ambulance, he said. Not sure you hit the weight limit there, buddy. He doesn't think about being famous anymore. Quote, that's not my job, being famous, he said. My job is to act. End of segment.
Love it. Love it.
Oh, my God.
Brilliant.
Next time on Again With This, Gina's shit stirring sends dumb shit Donna into the arms of shithead David. Lauren's miracle drug may actually kill her, and we hope the bear that menaces Steve and Janet's camping trip eats Dylan for considering getting back together with Kelly again. Or eats us, because good God, is this season going on for a long time. Somehow we doubt the amazing Bruno's going to have much of an appetite for our visual aids, but you can find those for this and every other episode of Again With This on our website at previously.tv. Follow that website on Twitter at previouslytv, and follow this podcast at EWT90210. I'm Terrible Disease Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is Greeting Card Holiday Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer is Double Espresso, David T. Cole. Talk to you next time.
Hi, you know what to do after the beeparoonie.
Opera. Fuck off.